Good evening. My name is Marissa Levine, and I am the director of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club, and I could not be more excited to welcome you all here tonight. Thank you. If you didn't already know, you're here for Beyond Prisons, a conversation about criminal justice reform with Shaka Sengor and Van Jones, focusing on one of the most critical issues facing the United States today. Now, I love that Van was just in our video, which is pretty fun. We're happy to have him back. But beyond the hundreds of amazing people that we get to bring you, the audience is full of brilliant, interesting, engaged people. So turn to your neighbor, say hello, make a friend. That's part of the event tonight. Thank you. And we would love to get you involved in the Commonwealth Club. We can't do what we do without members, donors, volunteers, and all of you. So to get involved, see one of us on your way out tonight. Now, coming up, we have a couple other programs that you might be interested in. April 27th, Cocktail Culture with the owner of Future Bars, hosted by Zendesk. May 4th, we bring you the chief data scientist of the United States, DJ Patil. And May 9th, we host Charles Duhigg on his new book, Smarter, Faster, Better. Now, tonight, we're also giving away a chance to win free tickets, to some Commonwealth Club programs coming up. Jay Newton Small, Michael Waldman, and Leslie Stahl. So see a staff member to enter to win. Now, after tonight's program, we are excited to be working with student partners from Minerva Schools, a new global liberal arts college reimagining higher education. They're in the audience. You can hear them. They will be hosting a post-event discussion with Defy Ventures, a nonprofit that provides entrepreneurship resources, employment, and character training to men and women with criminal histories. They liken themselves to Khan Academy merged with Y Combinator, which I like, San Francisco analogy. So after the program tonight, join some entrepreneurs in training from Defy, Minerva students, and other leaders up in the mezzanine for a post-program discussion at around 8 o'clock. Now, they will also be polling you on your way out, so vote with your stickers when you leave the theater. Now, most people tell you to turn off their cell phones. I will absolutely not do that. I will just tell you to turn off your ringers. We hate those. But we love live tweeting. So follow us at InforumSF. We'll be live tweeting tonight. We encourage you to join the conversation. And popular hashtags include Beyond Prisons and CJ Reform for this conversation. There will also be books for sale right here after the program. And if you'd like to get them signed by Shaka, please line up in an orderly fashion. Everybody will get them signed along the left-hand side here, and we will make that happen for you. Now, before we get to Van and Shaka, we have an incredible treat for you this evening. Tassiana Willis from Youth Speaks will be performing. Youth Speaks, through the intersection, some fans in the house, I like it. Now, through the intersection of arts education and youth development practices, civic engagement strategies, and high-quality artistic presentation, Youth Speaks creates safe spaces that challenge young people to find, develop, publicly present, and apply their voices as creators of societal change. So it is my pleasure to welcome Tassiana Willis to the stage.
Lord, don't give me a daughter I can't save her soul. Lord, don't give me a son, I can't afford the funeral. Lord, I don't want to bear any children. Said I don't want to bury your children. See, my insides are beginning to feel a lot more like factory than womb. See, my foremothers all birthed targets. So who am I to breed flesh and bone to burden anyone with black in a world already so dark? Thank you. So my name is Tassiana Willis, and I am the Emerging Artist Fellow at Youth Speaks. And before I left the stage, I just wanted to tell a really short sentence on why this topic is really important to me. On Monday, my mother called me and was like, "You have another sister." So I was like, "What? When did you get pregnant?" And she said it was on my father's side. Now, my father had never really been in my life. And what's sad is you've probably heard this story before. And sometimes I want to blame my father for never being in my life. But when he lives in a society that handcuffed him at 9 years old, and he's been in and out of prison his whole entire life since, how do you know how to be a father in that condition? And so I was stressed out, and I wanted to call my best friend. And then I remembered that he is behind bars. And I won't see my best friend for the next 23 years because he sent some text messages that they claimed to be threatening. He lived in a world that wouldn't even give him his papers, yet he's working behind bars for a country that won't even call him a human. So as we think about prison reform, let's think about love and forgiveness. Let's think about what redemption looks like. What does love look like in the arms of the redeemed? And how can we forgive? Thank you. Incredible.
Tassiana, I can't believe I have to say anything after that. But thank you. That was incredible, setting the stage for another incredible portion of tonight's program. For more on Youth Speaks, visit youthspeaks.org. And I hear they have a performance coming up Saturday night. They might want to see some of you there. And now it is my absolute pleasure to introduce Van Jones, president and co-founder of Cut 50, CNN political commentator and former White House special advisor, and Shaka Sangor, Director of Strategy and Innovation for Cut 50, and author of Righting My Wrongs, Life, Death, and Redemption in an American Prison. Join me in welcoming them to the Inforum stage.
Hey, Dog Nation! Yeah, y'all see that? Y'all see that? Thank y'all, thank y'all. Y'all far too kind.
Oh, Lord. Y'all missing the game. That's love.
Well, where's Tatiana? I gotta give you a hug. Like, that was beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah, give her a round of applause. That's extraordinary. Well, I think both of us are just blown away by the turnout.
It's the hat, man.
It's the hat. Yeah. But it's, you know, this is a city that I spent 20 plus years in and around working on these issues, and it used to be hard to get 15 people to talk about this in the middle of California, which is the incarceration capital of the world. So just give yourselves a round of applause for caring enough to start doing something about this. Let me get this on record because it's a radio show. So hi, everybody. I want to welcome you to tonight's program. Such an important time. I ain't going to do it. They'll have to edit that one out. It's a huge honor to be here. You know, Inforum is such an important part of the national dialogue, certainly the dialogue here in the Bay Area. And it's especially a big honor for me to be here with my brother, Shaka Sangor. We're going to have a real conversation. We're not going to do the scripted thing. We're not going to do the stuff that you maybe seen before. He has a TED Talk that goes very deep into his experience and how he wound up doing the time that he did. And most of you, if you've been tracking him, have noticed that since he's been home, he's been able to just achieve so many powerful things that really have given hope to people all around the world. So what we don't hear about and what we don't talk about is what happened in between. We know that you were in Detroit. We know that you were an abused child. We know that you ran away from home. We know that you got pulled into the gang life. We know that you got shot. We know that soon afterwards you shot back. You know that someone tragically lost their life. We know that you wound up going to prison, like so many young people do. We know that you didn't just do 19 years in prison, that you did 7 years in solitary confinement. I mean, just that by itself breaks so many people. We know that you transformed yourself into prison. We know when you got out, we know that you wrote a memoir that touched the hearts of everybody who's read it, Righting My Wrongs, and it, by a miracle, wound up in Oprah Winfrey's hands. You may have heard of her. We know that you've been to the White House now, invited twice.
First time didn't go so well.
First time didn't go so well. We'll get to that. We know that as a part of the hashtag Cut50 campaign and the hashtag Beyond Prisons campaign, you've been on the front lines in Washington, D.C., and Iowa, and Florida, and all these places pushing for real change. What happened in the middle? Most people are broken by what you went through. And if they weren't broken by being at the bottom, they would be real arrogant by being at the top. Something happened that allowed you to be as centered and grounded the first day I met you, coming out of hell, as you are right now in a situation where most people in this room, head would be so big, they would need two hats. So something happened in that middle passage, to coin a phrase. And I want you to tell us, if you would, what happened in the middle?
One of the first things that started me on a path toward turning my life around was meeting some of the most incredible mentors in the world. These are men who are my personal heroes. They've grown to be my personal friends. They held me accountable. They challenged me in ways that I never imagined that I can be challenged emotionally, spiritually.
Were these prison guards or wardens?
No, they're actually men that are serving life in prison. Life in prison. Some of them will die in prison. I communicate with them as frequently as possible, now that I'm home. The work that I do today is a testament to the work that they did when I first walked in prison. And I didn't listen to them right away. You know, it wasn't a quick fix. But they gave me books. Along my journey, I always met amazing men who gave me books. And I would devour the books, and then I would take them back to the library, and they didn't just let me turn them in. They would ask me questions about what I had read. They would challenge ideas and views I held as a result of reading those books. And I will forever pay homage to their humanity through my work. They are some of the unsung heroes of the whole prison reform movement, because anytime you see a man or a woman come out of prison who's centered, who's grounded, who care about something beyond herself, it's because they met those type of men.
Wow. Well, give it a round. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, part of the crazy thing is that because we do live in a country, we have, you know, 2.2 million people behind bars, $80 billion industry. You have been close up and personal with that industry. And now you actually go back and you mentor and you talk to people. How do you evaluate this $80 billion industry? Are we getting our money's worth?
Well, it's the only billion-dollar industry that has a 70% failure rate. So the answer to that is no. They're getting their money's worth, though. One of the things that was mind-blowing to me is that when I look at the unemployment rate for black and brown men in the country, it's shocking. Because when you look at the employment rate in prison, it's 100% employment rate. If you go to prison, you're guaranteed to be employed. You're actually forced to be employed at 13 cents, 17 cents, 24 cents an hour. I've worked in many spaces in prison, from cleaning a unit, which I made $9 a month doing, cleaning a unit full of frat house males. So it's like the worst frat house ever in the century. $9 a month to subject myself to the possibility of contracting hepatitis or whatever other blood-borne diseases that are in that environment. I've worked at the top of the employment chain in prison as a legal aide in prison library, law library. And I made an astounding $54 a month for work that's the equivalent of a paralegal. So the employment rate in there is 100%. So they're getting a return on their investment, especially those who have invested in private prisons. But in terms of what we're getting in return is a complete system of failure.
You know, you've already, I think, destroyed two myths that people have, which is that everybody in prison is violent and crazy, mm-hmm. And everybody in prison is lazy. So it's a place for crazy, lazy people. Right. But, you know, it's amazing to me because knowing you as well as I do, I think about the people who are the mentors that folks in this room would like to have. You have such a close relationship with Oprah Winfrey. You have such a close relationship with the Horowitz family. You have people in Silicon Valley that would push their best friend in front of a BART train to talk to Ben Horowitz. Somebody raised their hand. They're like, yes. They're like, I mean, this is somebody that you, he heard about you, he heard about your work, and you guys are very, very close. And you can walk through a whole list of other people. And yet, the people that you say were your most powerful and effective mentors are people society has decided to throw away forever. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not like you don't have a whole menu to choose from. Mm-hmm. But even with all of this, the people that you choose are those mentors. Can you just say something about the level of wasted genius behind bars?
Yeah, Some of the greatest legal minds are in prison, and it's really mind blowing to walk out of here and know like the caliber of men that are inside prison. The political minds are unbelievable. You know, the innovation. So one of the things, like, prison is a very innovative place for all you Silicon Valley people. I'd love to take you there one day and show you some things we made up. But what I discovered when I, as part of my fellowship with MIT Media Lab, is that there's this idea about design and you know, failure, learning through failure, and innovating and iterating on things. And one day I was at the lab, you know, working on my project, and I was just watching these brilliant people as they were walking through their projects and figuring out what worked, what didn't work, and just kind of tinkering with things.
At MIT?
It's the MIT Media Lab.
The smartest people in the world.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
Some of the smartest people in the world. So I came up with this idea to do a prison hack. And I was like, this would be fairly simple. I come up with 5 design challenges and offer them up to them. And I really just wanted to prove a simple, you know, point is that innovation takes place anywhere in the world. And so just a couple of the quick design challenges I came up with was to create a tattoo gun out of a tape player motor. For you young generation, that's the thing that used to play these plastic things, spin around and make a lot of music. I think I still have one. A tape player motor, a big pen, and a guitar string. because that's how I got all my tattoos. And some of them are pretty awesome. I would show y'all, but I can't unleash all this sexiness at one time. And then the other one. And then one of the other design challenges was to create a lighter out of two AA batteries and a piece of wire. And then the third one, which was kind of fun, is to create a stinger, which is a thing that we would use to heat up water. And as we embarked on this journey, I was like, they're going to ace this in like 5 minutes, and you know, then we'll just get into the discussion about it. We worked for about 2 hours, and they couldn't complete not one of the design challenges. We actually blew the power out at MIT Media Lab. I was like, yes! It's like, yes, this is great. This is awesome. But it proved a very significant point is that had they completed one of those design challenges, they would have been further validated as the geniuses that they are. In prison, when you create a design challenge, you're labeled a troublemaker and your innovation is criminalized. And so, you know, thinking about that whole process, you know, it led me back to, you know, how I ended up landing in the space as a writer.
Well, you know, first of all, I think probably most people assume that we met at a protest, you know, or, yeah, you know, trying to pass a bill someplace.
Right.
Actually met you because you were ahead of me in line as a fellow at MIT, welcoming me to MIT. So, I mean, yeah, just get your brain wrapped around some of this stuff. I want to talk to you about some of the stuff. Everybody here is trying to be a change maker. Yeah. I mean, most of the people, nobody's coming here because they like the status quo. You know, your work ethic when it comes to both reading and writing is just phenomenal.
Thank you.
You are one of the most prolific writers, not just one of the best writers from a qualitative point of view, but also from a quantitative point of view. The range that you write, fiction, nonfiction, personal. I mean, how did you learn that? And just explain to folks your discipline and your around that, because you're about to humiliate some people here who think they're like, it's so hard for me to complete this. I have a writer's block here at Starbucks. It's just so difficult. Can you break it down?
Oh man! So I started taking writing serious during what turned out to be a 4.5 year stretch in solitary confinement. It was one of the skill sets that I didn't even realize that I had until I was presented with the challenge to figure out how to leave something of meaning to my son. So I started off journaling, and I discovered through the process of journaling that I had never accomplished anything of significance in my life. And so I challenged myself. I said, if you really are sincere about turning your life around, write a book. And then I gave myself a very strict timeline to do it, 30 days. So.
Y'all look sad. y'all look real upset.
It actually gets even better.
Oh, God. Go ahead, brother.
Well, so the reality is I didn't have a typewriter. I didn't have a word processor or a laptop or any of those things. In solitary confinement, they give you a real flimsy pen because they don't want you, like, shanking anybody who try to open the food slot. And so I took the ink pen and I rolled it up in paper. And I had a little bit of experience rolling some things up, so pretty good at it. It's like, right. But that's how I began to write. And so I would write on notepads until I ran out of notepads. And so you can only order so many notepads in solitary, and I would write until I ran out of them, and then I would just write on the back of envelopes and you know, different things like that. And so that's how I began my process as a writer, or taking writing seriously. So I finished the first book in 30 days, sent it to a guy across the hall from me. He got super excited. Well, actually, initially, like, he didn't even respond. He didn't respond. So I thought he kept my only body of work, and I was, like, panicking. But when he came back, he was like, this is incredible, one of the best books I've ever read.
Wait, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
But you said you were in solitary confinement.
Yeah.
So how do you get a book to somebody?
So in solitary, we would make what's called fish lines, which we would take, like, the string out of our underwear and unravel it, and then we would connect it to a toothpaste tube, which we had emptied out and stuffed with toilet paper, and you wet the toilet paper, let it dry and get hard, and then you could slide it up and down the tier. You got to be real quick, because if the officer see it, they'll take it. But the interesting thing about this whole philosophy is that was kind of like our internet system back then. That's how we emailed each other, like, yo, bro, check your inbox. Send you something down the hall. But it was a way that we communicate, and you had to be real skilled at it, right? So, like, if a guy's way at the other end of the tier, you had to throw your line out, and he has to throw his across it, and then one of y'all had to snatch it real fast. And then that's how you connect them, and then you exchange information. And so that's how I got him the book. And you know, when he came to me, he was like, man, it's like best book I ever read. And I got, like, extremely excited. And then I just had to pause for him. And I was like, this dude is in solitary confinement. Like, anything I would have sent him would have been, like, awesome. But after that first book, you know, I realized that wasn't enough. I realized it wasn't enough. I realized that it's cool to do something one time, but the mark of greatness is when you can repeat it over and over again. And so I challenged myself to write a second book, which I completed in less than 30 days. Then I went on to start a third book, and in the midst of starting that third book, I fell into a really deep depression. And the depression came as a result of discovering that I had a dream worth living for, and that I was trapped in an environment that wouldn't allow me to give birth to that dream. And when you're in solitary confinement, they don't give you a definitive time of when they're going to let you out. It's part of the psychology behind why so many people have a breakdown, because there's no end in sight until somebody arbitrarily decides, hey, we should let them out one day. And so that's the only time I've ever had an experience which would be relatable to writer's block. But I didn't call it that. I called it what it truly was, which was severe depression. And fortunately for me, being literate, I was able to read Nelson Mandela's memoir, and one of the poems in there, Invictus, which I'm quite sure you all have heard, became kind of my saving grace to help me kind of navigate through the rest of my time in solitary.
I mean, it's just extraordinary because, I mean, most of us have dreams too that we're not achieving, and have excuses for not achieving them that we can't share with you because, by way of just perspective and comparison. You know, 5 years ago, about, you were behind bars. 5 years plus, you were in solitary confinement. That is the toughest place in American society, in on earth. And somehow in that situation, you were able to find a way to do stuff that people walk around here every day with laptops and cell phones and whatever. We block ourselves. So one thing I know meeting you, I feel like we're all in prison. It's just some of us that are in prison on the inside. And it seems to me that you were able to break out of your internal prison first. And then the walls kind of came down after that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we never had this conversation before. You know, I know, you know, I'm a person of faith. I call myself a Christian. I grew up in the black church. I relate to the kind of black faith church tradition of Dr. King and social struggle. I don't ever hear you say those words, but I know that there must be a spiritual root that has blossomed so beautifully. How do you see yourself as a spiritual person?
Yeah, so my spirituality evolved over the years. I grew up like typical black child in the hood. My mother, you know, took us to church, put us some little tight little Easter suits on, had us in there with little pastel colors, like, hey, mom from the hood, like, just like this folk.
My mom, the polyester mom.
Right.
Please, not that.
But what I found, one of the reasons that I don't talk a lot about my faith is because I believe that a lot of times when people overemphasize it, it means they're deeply insecure about what they believe. And I just try to live my life based on the fundamental principle of what I think spirituality is. It's a connection to the infinite abundance of the universe. And it manifests in every aspect of our life, whether it's health, wealth, emotional connections. The world is full of abundance. And when I began to dream of my life after prison and beyond prison, it was centered in that belief that the world is infinitely abundant in compassion, empathy, human connection, and the ability to accomplish anything that we set our minds to. More importantly, what we center our spirits on. And it's one thing to say that you believe something, but it's a whole different thing to live your life rooted in that belief. And so in recent months, people have been like, you know, how do you feel about meeting Oprah? And you know, you don't seem really excited. And I'm actually really excited. Y'all got to trust me on this one. Believe me. But part of it is for me, spiritually it feels like a normal, natural progression because I believed in the dream from the moment I wrote it down. And despite everything I was going through in there, I never allowed anything to shake me away from my faith and my belief that the universe is open to sharing the abundance that we know the world to be.
Yeah. Well, you know, how did you get out of solitary? I mean, I say that because it's one thing for you to be saying this now when you're a New York Times bestseller, when, you know, you've been, you know, you're on TV more than I am. I mean, that's, you know, so, which I don't feel bad about. But the first test of that faith was to get out of there, get out of solitary. You had to get from solitary to jail.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it was like, I have a dream to get to jail. You know, like, yeah. Like, how did that happen?
So when I was in solitary, when I first went, so just to kind of frame it and put it in context, I was in solitary in prison was one of the absolute worst infractions you can commit if you're trying to get out of prison, which is assault on a staff member. And typically, you don't get out of solitary, and that's what they told me, that I would probably never get out of solitary. And they labeled me as one of the worst. And when I discovered the dream, the power of the dream is like is so much bigger than me. Part of it was fueled by what I saw happening around me. In solitary, I saw some of the worst abuses known to mankind take place, specifically against those who suffer from mental illness. And I knew then that I had a responsibility as a writer because I can articulate their experience in ways that they couldn't. And I knew that there was nothing that was going to stop that dream from getting out. And so I wrote the warden, and I explained to him that, you know, I know that there's no intention or no desire to ever release me, but I can guarantee you, absolutely guarantee you, that if you do, it'll be one of the best decisions you've ever made as an administrator. And I wrote it in such a compelling way that he actually responded. It was like, I believe you, and I'm willing to give you a chance. And so he agreed for me to be released from solitary confinement.
After an assault on a staff?
Staff, yeah. Actually a very serious assault on the staff. And y'all will read more about that in the book. But he agreed to release me, and then it went up to his higher up, and they refused to release me. And so I ended up staying another year in solitary confinement, and then I decided to write them with a similar, you know, a similar letter. And they eventually released me, and I had this, you know, this I had told the guys on the cell block that if I was ever released from solitary confinement, that I would George Jefferson stroll out of the cell block.
The young folk have no idea what you're talking about.
Right. I'm like, George Jefferson stroll,
you can tell right now of age, birth, by who laughed.
But it was kind of like, but it was based on the premise that I was actually moving on up to a new me. That was important. Yeah.
So, what? I'm trying to imagine this situation. So, you've been able to literally, from the darkest place, find a dream that's beautiful enough, and find a voice, and find a way, and a skill as a writer to be able to communicate with the people whose job it is to say no, and get them to open their heart and to say yes. Now, you're in. Back in general population, what was the thing you wanted the most in that situation?
In general population, or when I got home?
Either.
When I got home?
Yeah. All right, yeah.
I've been gone for 19 years, so I really, 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 really wanted to be able to make my own choices about every aspect of my life, to be fully free, fully present, in the experience of being a human being. You know, prison is a very volatile environment. And what you feel every day in that environment is the complete opposite of what it means to be a human being. Everything is about guarding who you are, protecting who you are, guarding your possessions. It's a very guarded space. And to live in that environment for 19 years... with that shell up, that wall up.
How old were you when you went in?
I was 19 years old.
Wow.
So I actually got out. I got out of prison one day after my 38th birthday. So I had spent half of my life in and half of my life out. And so that's what I wanted. I wanted the feeling of, you know, just being able to go in the refrigerator and drink orange juice that I selected. To be able to eat food that, you know, was based on my palate and not just, you know, excuse me, this general, you can tell I just ate some food. I'm like, burping, belching.
But it was your food.
Yeah, it was worth it, yeah. So it was just, it's the ability to make choices and to just be human.
Yeah.
Be human.
Well, you more than I mean, I just really, I think everybody here is just a level of respect and admiration that I have for you and that everybody has for you. I think it just comes from just acknowledgement that most of us have gone through 0.02% of what you've gone through and are still tripping. and can't imagine coming through a situation like you went through anything but bitter. And you're not bitter, you're better. That's an extraordinary achievement. I mean, it's just something that, I just saw Diana Frappier here. By the way, give Diana Frappier a big round of applause. One of the best organizers and activists, a co-founder of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, and my sister Diana Frappier right there. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for Diana Frappier. She's right there. Hey, sister, I love you. Where was I? You got me confused. I won't say nothing. Anyway, but just my point is that I think you show people what's possible. And I think you also know how many people you left behind. What are the things that people who are still on that journey, people may be listening around the world, around the country, on the internet, who are behind bars or who have people behind bars. What do people need that people may not even realize that folk need while they're there and also when they come home?
Yeah, the most important gift I've ever been given is a gift of hope. Like, it doesn't cost us much to extend hope to people who are in hopeless situations. And being able to be given that lifeline, it allowed me to dream. And when I was inside, it came in many different ways. You know, it came from, again, from my mentors. It came from reading. It came from seeing a model of what it looks like to transform your life in the form of Malcolm X's autobiography. Mm. You know, human resilience, which is really what it's about. And understand, as you're working through any obstacle, you always have a choice. You always have a choice. And when I realized that I had a choice to dream as big and as expansive as possible, or I had a choice to shrink myself further, it was a no-brainer. Mm. But that came from having hope. And, you know, I tell people all the time, like, you know, we have over 2 million men and women incarcerated. And we've thrown them away. And a simple letter, you know, a simple picture of the community, you know, a simple phone call can be the turning point for somebody. You know, my friends are you know, in doing this work, you know, I'm very intentional about not calling the men I left behind. Well, I didn't even leave them behind, but the men whose presence I'm no longer in, I'm very intentional about not calling them inmates or offenders or convicts. Or all these other things that takes away from their humanity.
Yes, yes.
These are my friends. Prison is the neighborhood I grew up in. That was my community. And I'm a firm believer.
Well, just hold on a second, man. Trying to find you. Okay, good, all right.
It's all good.
Okay, good. But you said something very, very profound. And the rest of y'all, cut your phone off, too. You just said something that's very, very profound. Not only did you say that you don't use the term inmate and convict and sort of thing, you say men, you know, people, mm-hmm. my friends, and the prison, the neighborhood that you grew up in. I think that's so humanizing, and it's so sad that we even have to be humanizing humans.
Yeah.
But you were going somewhere.
Yes, and so, you know, it's that same hope when a person is walking out. It's so important for us to have that. You know, the challenges are seemingly insurmountable. I know I'm not an anomaly. Like, I have friends that are doing incredible work throughout the world. I meet men and women all the time. In every city I've gone in, I've met incredible men and women who are formerly incarcerated, who are working to change the world, who are working to make their communities better, and some of them who are just regular, everyday working people, but they're good people.
Yeah.
And they have hearts, and they have spirits, and they have souls. And we live in a society, which is shocking to me, that we live in a society to where we have created the idea of the other for so long that it stripped us of our humanity and the fabrics and the cornerstones of what most people would say is their faith. If you talk to most citizens in this country, they would say that they practice some type of faith or another, with the exception of maybe those who are atheists or agnostic. The cornerstone of faith is forgiveness, redemption, second chances. But we refuse that to extend that to the men and women who are currently incarcerated. And we keep it away from those who are coming home. Because somehow in this strange society that we live in, there's this desire to always feel superior. And it happens everywhere. You know, it happens everywhere. And so, you know, when you think about it, I'm quite sure everybody in here has done something that they're not proud of. Some of y'all shouldn't be proud of how y'all dressed today. I seen y'all. Now, jokes. It's all jokes.
Detroit.
But seriously, every one of us have had a moment that we've probably never shared with anybody else. None of us will want to be held hostage to that one moment for the rest of our lives. But that's what we do to the men and women coming home. So the thing that's needed is we have to wrap our arms around our brothers and sisters coming back. You know, we have to see their humanity. They've served their time. And we have to create a space for transformation to take place. We have to create a space where men and women feel welcomed home, welcome back to, you know, society. And I'll just say this last point before your next question. I went to Germany last June, and I visited around 6 prisons in Germany. So y'all know I really, really care about my people in the joint if I'm going to Germany to go to prison, like, with their history, right? When I went there, I was shocked. I just knew that I was going to visit the most cold, barbaric, inhumane prison system in the world. It had to be. It's Germany. That's what I thought. It's my thoughts going over there. But when I went over there, I saw something that absolutely blew my mind. They treat the men and women who are incarcerated like family. From the very moment that they get incarcerated, they begin to work on re-socializing them back to society. They're allowed to, They're allowed to work in the community no matter the length of their sentence. Think about that. They actually get allowed to work in the community. It's mandatory that they have access to conjugal visits. And not just to hook up kind, but to spend time with their family and connect and bond. They don't use solitary confinement to destroy people and to break people's soul. They don't believe in sentencing children to life in prison. And so that was mind-blowing. And the deepest part of it was I was talking to the warden. And when I told her how long I did in solitary confinement, she began to weep.
The warden?
The warden.
Of a prison in Germany?
Of a prison in Germany. And what she said to me was, we would never do that to one of our citizens. And so that motto was mind-blowing. And it was one of the most revealing moments for me because I'm not the type of person that really gets down in self-pity.
Right.
But in that moment, I felt sorry for myself and the young man that I was in solitary confinement. Because here it is, a woman in a whole other country was weeping for an experience that we laugh at and we mock in our country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like we just, I don't even know what to say to that. That's, you know, it's one of the things I think is so interesting about your experience. I think about you going to Germany, invited by some of the top people in the United States to go. Mm-hmm. I think about you at MIT being the standout superstar at MIT. I think about you with, you know, all of these people. But I also know the first year or two when you got out of prison, there was no flying carpet for you to step onto.
Yeah.
Just explain to people, even someone as extraordinary as you are, what are the barriers when folks come home that we need to deal with?
So since I've been out, I've never had a formal job. every application, every resume I put in was basically denied. And it is by far the most demoralizing feeling in the world to want to do the right thing and to be told that you're basically unworthy of being able to do it. I remember one of the moments that was, actually a couple of moments that was crushing. So I did this interview after I put in, you know, a application for this job. And it was a perfect job for my skill set and my experience. It was working with men who were coming out of incarceration, who had substance abuse and homeless issues. And I remember part of it was working on their digital strategy and their social media strategy and figuring out partnerships. And I went in with a very innovative presentation. And it was so compelling to them that they just was like mind blown. And I walked out of there knowing that they would hire me. And then I got a letter in saying they chose to go in a different direction. And so I was like, well, okay, you know, I'm a competitive guy. You know, I'm like, well, direction they went in, he must be a bad something, you know. He had to come in and just blow their socks off, you know. And as a, you know, as a competitive person, I can accept that. You know, that's perfectly fine. Because I believe that if I don't rise to the occasion and do what I need to do, then I shouldn't be rewarded for mediocrity. But then I talked to one of the women who's, you know, a family friend, and she told me that ultimately what happened is that they decided not to hire me because of my felony and not because of my inability to do the job. And I remember sitting on the back porch, you know, Ebony and I were sitting in the front row with our son, Sekou. You know, Sekou was either just about to be born or had just been born. And as a father, I'm thinking about, you know, how am I going to take care of my child? And I remember holding my phone and just thinking to myself, like, I know with one phone call, I can get back in the game because the streets are always hiring. And, you know, as a man and as a father, ultimately my responsibility is to take care of my child by any means. And so, you know, that moment was you know, mind-blowing. And then shortly after that, we were attempting to move because, you know, the car that I had, it got stolen a couple of times, and I didn't want to expose my family to that level of vulnerability. And we were only in the neighborhood we were in because it was one of the few apartments that would allow me to rent with my name on the lease because, again, I have a felony. And when you have a felony, you can be legally discriminated against when it comes to housing, and it's absolutely nothing you can do about it. You can't file a lawsuit and say they're keeping me out because I have a felony because it's legal to discriminate. And so at this time, we were looking for an apartment, and I had some of the greatest references. I mean, I had Joy Ito at the Media Lab. I was, think I was just getting in the process of starting to teach a class at the University of Michigan. And so I had all these great people to support me and back me and verify that I would be a responsible tenant. And we still got denied. You know, they would run background checks and be like, oh, you got a felony. And I'm like, well, I can't take the felony off my record ever. And they're like, well, you'll never be able to rent here ever. And so, you know, it forced me into home ownership, which I wasn't even ready for. But those are just some of the obstacles, you know. And I'm fortunate in the sense that I had friends who can help me get a home. Otherwise, I would have been homeless or back in the streets. And this is what, you know, the idea of second chance is not. It's not necessarily about coddling people and rewarding people for poor decisions. It's about giving people a fair chance to live with dignity and respect.
Well, Chaka Sen Gore. I feel super lucky. I get a chance to talk to him almost every day. Well, since the book came out, not so much. But if you have questions, we're going to be taking questions We're going to come to you with a wireless microphone, so I want you to think about what your questions are. Staff member is going to bring you the mic when it's your turn. As a reminder, we want you to ask. Single, one-part questions that are actually questions. You see? Can I get a round of applause for questions in the Bay Area that are actually questions that have question marks at the end and would only be maybe one, at most two lines long if they were on paper. So as we begin to bring the microphones around to people, I do want to say I know a lot of people want to know how to get involved, how to get engaged, what they can do. There are three things that I would like to say. You know, Shock and I are both a part of something called hashtag Cut50. That's a campaign. Yes, y'all can clap for Cut50. That's a campaign to cut the prison population in the United States in half, at least, over the next 10 years, using smart solutions. You may be aware here locally, Jessica Jackson, Matt Haney. Y'all clap for Jessica Jackson and Matt Haney. Both major forces inside the Cut 50 movement. Cut 50 is actually at the Dream Corps, which I believe Summer Huntley is here, Nisha Anand is here. So we have a lot of...
Alex Gulich,
also from Cut 50. Give Alex a round of applause. So we have a lot of serious fighters here for Cut 50 and also for a program called the hashtag Beyond Prisons, which is also a part of it. The three things that you can do, one is to buy one of Shaka's books and buy another one to give to someone else. This is a truly life-transforming memoir. There are very few books that, after you read them, you are a different person. He mentioned Nelson Mandela's book was a transformative book. Malcolm X's book. This is a book in that league, at that level, by, according to everybody, including the New York Times Book Review. Oh, and by the way, please give him a round of applause. He is a New York Times best-selling author. New York Times best-selling author, 5 years out of prison.
Thank y'all so much. Thank y'all.
Yeah, it's amazing. Also, you can go to cut50.org. That's cut50.org. If you want to make a donation, we have a whole campaign. You know, he's one of the most selfless people I've ever met, and there are so many other voices that Jessica and Shaka and others want to bring forward. And so if you want to help us get more voices forward, help him get more people heard, you can go to cut50.org. And also, you can sign up there to be a part of our Year of Empathy. So those are the three things. Give another round of applause to Shaka Singh.
Thank you so much.
Okay, we have our first question from audience right over here. Yeah, over here. It's from Chris. Here we go.
For your question.
Hi, my name's Chris, and I live in one of my... this really hits close, very close to home to me, because as we speak, my cousin is sitting in Pelican Bay Supermax State Prison, and he's probably never going to get out. And I can't remember who said it, but that when you were saying that the conditions of prison in some countries are a lot more humane than in the United States, I thought to myself, the United States also criminalizes a lot of behavior that other countries don't criminalize, such as the war on drugs, as everybody knows, or we have a much more stringent attitude toward things like prostitution that other countries don't necessarily have. So my question to you is that what do you think is the most critical thing that the United States could reform in order to either reduce the recidivism rate or prevent people from even entering the criminal justice system in the first place?
Shaka.
Yeah, one of the first things and most important is the decriminalization of mental illness. I think we can all agree that it is completely deplorable to treat people with mental illness in a manner that is abusive, dehumanizing, degrading, And I think that that's an area that we should really put a lot of our energy and efforts into, because the level of mental illness inside prison would blow most people's mind if they ever just had an opportunity to see what was happening.
What do you mean when you say mental illness?
So, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression, like severe, you know, like, you know, one of the mind-blowing things I experienced in solitary confinement was men that they labeled as cutters.
Cutters?
Cutters, and I had never heard that experience. And these were men who would literally self-mutilate with anything that they can get their hands on. And instead of getting them treatment, they would, you know, chain them down to a bed so that they couldn't cut themselves, as opposed to getting them, like, real psychological treatment.
I mean, I would imagine that would make it worse, though. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, it definitely increased the mental deterioration. And so that's one of the things I think we can work on, like the mental illness piece is really important.
Second question.
We have a question front and center from Dory.
Hey, Dory.
Hey.
It's my girl.
Glad Memorial Church up in the house. Give Dory a hand.
Hi. So my question is for Shaka and Van. Can you talk about, you referenced the two visits to the White House. Can you share the story about the visit to the White House the first time?
Yeah.
Yes, you could get me in a lot of trouble, but go ahead.
Yeah, so I'll take the heat for this one, because I can say what I want to about the White House. So we were invited, Cut 50 was invited to the White House to discuss criminal justice reform. Earlier that day, we were actually in New York, me, Matt Haney, and Van Jones. At another meeting, we rushed off, took a train to D.C. We were running through the streets with suits on, and you know it'd take a lot for me to put a suit on. I'm not a suit-type dude. This must have been really important. I'm running through literally streets with my luggage and a suit on, and we get to the White House, and I was like, all right, Matt, you go first, because, you know, I always get nervous going through any type of security situation. I think I got a little bit of a reason to feel a little nervousness around police. So I'm like, Matt, okay, you go ahead. Let's see how this process works out. So Matt goes through. He gets cleared. I go, and I give him my ID, and they were like, just hold on 1 second, sir. And that's never, like, a good sign when you, like, talk to her. Anytime they tell you to hold on, it's going downhill from there. You know what it means. They call it for more backup. They doing something. It's not going to be good. They were like, you're not on the list. So I'm frantically texting Nissa from our team and Alex. Hey, they won't let me in the White House. They're like, I'm not on the list. So they're sending me the list. And I'm looking at it, and I see my name is clearly on there. And long story short, I ended up being outside of the White House for probably an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, 90-degree weather in a hot suit. And Matt, you know, being the generous soul that he is, he refused to go inside until they gave me access. So he stood out as a friend.
And then he lost access.
And then he lost access. but in the midst of this, Van was speaking, and you know, and he was just telling them that, you know, while it was great for him to be on the stage sharing the story about criminal justice reform, there was somebody a little bit more informed about the issue who was being denied access. And the White House reacted to the emotional expression of you know, what was happening, and they eventually let me inside, which was, you know, pretty cool and, you know, a testament to real friendship, because he could have easily not said anything, which some people do when they're in positions that are kind of fragile with, you know, political relationships. But that was the first experience. Then the second experience, I was actually just going there to be a part of a welcome home experience for men and women whose sentences have been commuted, and just to fellowship with them and really hear their stories and testimony. So it was just really an honor and to see that, you know, the current president is actually making some strides toward reducing some of the severe sentences related to mandatory minimums and giving people an opportunity to reconnect with their families and heal and be whole again. So...
I just want to add one thing to the story, which he, you know, in his typical modesty, you know, that was a very difficult moment to be asked to come to the White House and then barred. But Valerie Jarrett, who may as well be the vice president, Yeah, I said it. Really took it to heart what happened. And she came over and talked to him directly, eye to eye. I mean, people will spend millions of dollars to have 5 seconds with Valerie Jarrett. She came over, talked to him directly, eye to eye. And then the next time he went, not only did he not have any problems, not a single person had a problem, because they changed whatever was the tripwire, which had probably insulted and offended so many people. But, you know, the relation, just the connection that Valerie made and really understanding what a great man was being excluded, he has opened a door now for people to get into the White House forever. Give him a round of applause. This is an incredible dude. You know, and it literally, nobody had a problem that day. I mean, nobody had a problem that day. And I don't think they've had those problems anymore. Let's get the third question in.
All right, we have another question from the right over here from Tennille.
I hope it's not from the real right.
Right. Okay. She's back up there.
Hi, thank you. Shakur, I haven't read your book yet, but I assume that you receive support when you're incarcerated from people on the outside, and I assume that was the case for a lot of the men that you were there with. Could you say something about the kind of support you received and what we can do for those people who have to go through the trauma of having someone that they love incarcerated?
Yeah, thank you so much for asking that question. So one of the things that makes me work as hard as I do to be there for my friends is because the majority of people who are incarcerated don't have anybody. And it's one of the worst feelings in the world to be at your most vulnerable state and to not have anybody to have your back. For me, I was very, very fortunate. I had a father who refused to leave my side no matter what.
Please say that.
I remember having this conversation with my father when I ended up in solitary for the last time, and they told me that I was never getting out of solitary. I told my father to go on with his life and to not worry about me, that I'll figure out how to survive whatever they throw at me. And he was like, you know, I would never leave your side. And so, you know, his support for the duration of the 19 years was invaluable. And then four years prior to me getting out, I met this amazingly beautiful woman, Ebony, who's sitting in the front. You should all meet her, because she's, like, extremely important. So when I met Ebony, met her through her activism work. She went inside. She actually came into one of the programs I organized in prison by accident. My friend who got out prior to me was supposed to came back in to the program, and he couldn't get in. And so she was sent in his place. And so we met at that program, and she came in and she spoke, and just a brilliant, brilliant woman. She hadn't long, you know, had got her PhD. She's beautiful like a model, and she came in to spend her time with us little heathens. And so the following year, she wrote me, and she was like, you know, I'm really impressed with, you know, the way that you conducted the program. And, you know, I'm not sure if you have friends writing you, but I would love to write you. And so I responded to her letter. It was like, listen, I learned this. So here's a valuable lesson I learned, is that you don't get what you don't ask for. I wrote her and was like, you know, I not only want to be a pen pal, but I want to get to know all of you. And we became, like, great, great friends, and we began to build the idea of dreaming, of, you know, sharing a life together and dreaming as big as possible. And she is, like, a super soldier in terms of just her support And she went through the ringer with me, and you'll read about it in the book. But it's a testament to her resilience as well. And so between her and my father, the human touch that I needed to come home healthy and whole, they added it in very different ways. So she kind of opened up my heart space to be able to receive love, which is, you know, it's hard to do when you're in an environment that's so volatile and testosterone-driven. So I thank her for that. And if my father was here, I would be thanking him, too. And just to the other part of your question of what you can do is just reach out. You know, if you have a loved one inside, take that two-hour trip, that three-hour trip, every now and then just to say, you know what, I haven't forgot you. And that no matter what you've done, you're still worthy of a hug or a handshake. I currently have a younger brother that's incarcerated, and I go see him when I'm home. You know, whenever I have free time, I don't get up there as often as I would like because I'm, you know, busy, but I will never let him feel like he's alone and that don't nobody care. There's an app that I use called JPay where I communicate with all of my friends in prison through this app. And it doesn't cost me much, you know. I send them pictures through the app. You know, I send them money. You know, I can't send everybody money unless I get a raise from Cut 50 or something. Send my brothers in jail. I need to send my brothers in jail money raise. But, you know, it's just that small, the small things of being able to be there for another human. And then send information. You know, people ask me how I was able to adjust to society. I would hear about stuff, you know, Facebook and Twitter and smartphones. And I would just say, you know, Ebony, can you send me information? And she would print it out and send stuff to me. And that's how I learned about Facebook and all that type of stuff. So just send information, stuff you're learning about. Help let them learn about it. You know, keep us alive and connected to the world. And send a lot of pictures. Yeah.
Good stuff. So that's going to be our last question. So I'm gonna ask you a question about a 60-second idea that you have that could change the world, but I'm going to give you a second to get yourself together on that one. Speaking of raises, speaking of raising voices and everything else, your donations can help a great deal of this cause. A lot of people care, but you don't know what to do. A lot of people want to see change, you don't know how to get it. The reason that Jessica Jackson and Matt Haney and Alex and Shaka and all these people work so hard is because they are figuring this out. And so there are going to be people at the back that have iPads that you can sign up for. And those of you who are under the sound of my voice, please go to cut50.org and see what's going on. There's a movement that's being built. That said, I'm going to give you 60 seconds to give us an idea that could change the world. It's a tradition here at Inform. We ask every guest, 60-second idea to change the world.
Wow, that's a lot of pressure. but I guess to me, it's a real basic idea. The idea is to extend empathy, love, and human compassion in spaces that aren't in your natural ecosystem. And I think that the work that we do and the work that, you know, many other people are doing to change the world is a way that we can do that. So I just ask you to step out on faith, you know, step out of your comfort zone and extend human empathy, you know, and that shows up in all type of forms, you know, volunteering, you know, donating, talking, discussing, reading books, having online discussions, but extend that into unfamiliar territories and the world will be a better place.
Very, very good. Now, the one person that we haven't acknowledged, I got a lot of people here I could acknowledge. We have people here from Yes We Code, which is an amazing organization, Green for all these folks. But the one person we have not acknowledged is probably the most extraordinary person here. His name is Sekou. And let him get up here. Let him get up here. This is the son of Ebony and Shaka Singor, Lil Sekou. Give this young man a round of applause. Give him a standing ovation. This young man is extraordinary. Let him know how much you love him, how much you love his father, how much you love his mother, how much you love his daddy's book, how much you love justice. Everybody all together, I say, we love Sekou. We love Sekou. We love Sekou. We love Sekou. All right. Now,
So for anybody who looked on the cover of the book, whoever has the book, that's Sekou on the book, so he's forever part of a New York Times bestseller's history and legacy. Yeah. I love you, Poopy.
Yeah. Very good. Now, listen, I want to say, if you want to get your copy of Righting My Wrongs, Life, Death, and Redemption in American Prison, signed by Shaka, please line up on the far left side of the theater. And thank you very much. Hey.